I used to believe I was saving the world, that my work, my devotion, had purpose, that the man with the wild eyes and velvet voice had chosen me because he saw something divine. But today, the air is thick with poison, and people are dying at my feet, all because I obeyed. This isn't a memory, it's a confession. You want to understand how I ended up kneeling on a Tokyo subway floor, gripping a punctured umbrella tip with blood under my nails? Then listen closely. Because by the time I realized I was part of a death cult, the train had already left the station, and there was no way back. If you haven't already, make sure to follow us and tap the notification bell. We drop new content every day. Stay tuned so you never miss a story.
Chapter 1, The First Whisper. I wasn't the kind of woman you'd notice on a crowded train. Most mornings I stood with my back pressed against the cold steel door of the Chiyoda line, eyes down, briefcase clutched like a lifeline. My colleagues in the lab called me efficient. My mother called me lonely. I preferred the term invisible. It was easier to survive that way. No expectations, no vulnerability, no need to explain why my apartment still echoed, why I cried when I smelled cherry blossoms, why my fingernails were always bitten raw. But invisibility doesn't make you immune. It just makes you ripe. It started on a Thursday. I remember because the rain had been relentless all week, soaking my hemline and my mood, the gray sky leaking into my chest like ink. I was 2 months deep into a research assignment on neurotransmitter disruption when Dr. Yanagida, my only mentor, was suddenly reassigned without explanation. One day he was there, humming Debussy at his desk. The next, his nameplate was gone, and my inbox was filled with unsigned directives. That same evening, as I walked home past the half-lit alley behind the university lab, I heard it. A voice. Soft. Intentional. You look like you're searching for something they can't give you. I turned. A man stood just outside the shadow of a vending machine, his suit pristine despite the drizzle, his hands tucked neatly behind his back. He smiled, not with kindness but curiosity, as though he already knew what kind of void I carried in my chest. I'm not selling anything, he said before I could speak. Just offering a door most people are too afraid to see. I laughed awkwardly. I'm not religious. Neither am I, he said. But science has limits. And you know that, don't you? He didn't ask my name. Didn't offer his. He just handed me a pamphlet, printed on thick, expensive paper. No images. Just a phrase in crimson ink. Only those who suffer truly understand the path to transcendence. I should have thrown it away. I should have kept walking. But I didn't. Because the words crawled into my head like a whisper I'd been waiting my whole life to hear. The first meeting wasn't what I expected. It wasn't held in a shrine or an underground lair. It was in a clinical white room in an old office tower downtown. The windows were blacked out. There were no chairs, only cushions arranged in a perfect spiral. A dozen people sat in complete silence, eyes closed, breathing in unison. He was already there. Asahara. He didn't look like a prophet. He looked like an exhausted professor who hadn't slept in days. Beard unkempt, robe slightly wrinkled. But when he opened his mouth, the room leaned forward like it had no choice. You are not here by accident, he said. You were summoned because you see. Because the world outside this room is a rotting husk, and your suffering is not a flaw. It's a signal. A preparation. He looked directly at me then. Not through me. At me. I felt something shift inside. Something terrible and soothing. It's terrifying how quickly loneliness can be mistaken for calling. Over the next few weeks, I started skipping my morning train. I began lying to my supervisor, saying I had migraines, or that my mother was sick. The truth was less noble. I was attending lectures in a darkened room that reeked of incense and secrets. They didn't talk about gods. They talked about purity, about removing the toxins of the modern world, about how only those with the capacity to suffer deeply could help lead humanity into a new era. The man next to me, Daisuke, was a former physicist. He said he'd worked on military contracts. He said guilt made his bones ache at night. But in the temple room, he felt peace. Purpose. It's not about death, he whispered one night as we packed away the cushions. It's about rebirth. We're not destroying anything. We're purifying it. I wanted to believe him. I wanted to believe that maybe my pain, my desperate longing for something more, wasn't a flaw. Maybe it was a sign. And so, I kept going back. The first assignment they gave me was simple. Test a compound. Nothing dangerous, the handler assured me. Just experimental. You're a scientist, after all. We trust your expertise. The vial was unmarked. The liquid inside, translucent and still. I ran it through the usual protocols: spectrometry, toxicity, enzyme interaction. It was volatile, frighteningly so, but not unstable. The chemical signature reminded me of something I'd studied in grad school, a formula buried deep in a textbook no one quoted anymore. Sarin. But I said nothing. I wrote my report, omitting the most crucial observation. I convinced myself it was part of a test, a theoretical model, a scare tactic, nothing more. I didn't realize it then, but I had already crossed a threshold. Not with a scream, but a silence. That's how manipulation works. Not by force, not by chains, but by offering you exactly what you need, just twisted enough to own you. That night, lying in my futon, the city outside my window alive with neon and noise, I held the pamphlet under my pillow like a child hiding a diary. Only those who suffer truly understand the path to transcendence. The words no longer frightened me. They felt like scripture. They felt like home. Chapter 2. The Experiment of Faith. You don't notice the moment obedience becomes identity. It's not a switch, it's erosion. Silent, constant, comfortable. By the time I was invited into the inner lab, I no longer referred to myself as Haney. At least, not in my head. I was the vessel, as they called me, chosen because I understood both science and suffering. It sounds ridiculous now, I know. But in that room, with its white walls and scripture-scribbled glass, it felt like a promotion. A spiritual advancement cloaked in sterilized authority. The lab was hidden beneath a former bathhouse outside Tokyo, retrofitted with airlock doors, cameras, and biometric locks that clicked like bones. The first time I stepped in, I noticed how quiet it was. Not a silence of peace, but of anticipation. As if even the walls were holding their breath. I was led by a woman named Noriko, older than me, pale-eyed and devout in a way that unnerved me. She never blinked when she spoke. She always smiled, even when describing death. "This is where the real healing begins," she whispered, brushing her gloved fingers along a chrome tray. "You're ready now, Haney. You've suffered enough." I nodded. I didn't question her anymore. I had been taught that questions were the crutches of the unenlightened. They gave me formulas, some of them familiar, others laced with unfamiliar radicals. They handed me glass vials, sealed in velvet-lined boxes. "Analyze. Enhance. Purify," they said. But it wasn't purification. It was preparation. One particular compound, compound Delta 7, was unmistakable. A derivative of sarin. Colorless. Odorless. Lethal in microliters. I knew this. I had written a dissertation on it 6 years ago. And yet, I labeled it cleansed agent, as instructed, and passed it forward. Some part of me, what little remained untouched, screamed. It clawed at my insides like an animal in a burning cage. But I silenced it. I told myself I was saving the world from its own sickness. That pain was the purifier. That death in the right context was rebirth. That's the thing about manipulation. When it's done right, it doesn't just silence your doubt, it weaponizes it against you. The deeper I went, the more the world outside faded. I stopped calling my mother. I stopped paying rent. When my university paycheck stopped depositing, I didn't notice. I was moved into a collective dormitory where we wore identical gray robes, ate from wooden bowls, and attended nightly sermons. And he was always there, Asahara. Not physically, not always, but his voice lived in every hallway. His image adorned the walls like a god with human flaws. I saw him once up close during a small blessing ceremony. He touched my forehead. He whispered one word. Faith. I wept. Not because I was moved, but because I finally felt seen. Then came the testing phase. Noriko explained it casually, like a midterm exam. Volunteers only, she said. Chosen souls. We must see how the spirit reacts under chemical awakening. A man was brought into the chamber. Thin. Eyes wide with admiration. A robe-clad disciple. He bowed as if greeting destiny itself. I stood behind the glass, fingers trembling over the console. The compound in my hands was barely altered sarin, suspended in aerosol. Meant to simulate controlled transcendence. "You are the bridge," Noriko reminded me. "Don't hesitate. His pain is the offering." The seal hissed. The vapor filled the air. At first he smiled. Then he coughed. Then he collapsed. His face turned a color I didn't know skin could turn. His mouth foamed. His eyes rolled back. He twitched once, then stopped. Noriko clapped twice. "Beautiful," she said. "He's free." I vomited in the corridor. Not because he died, but because a part of me believed it was beautiful. Later that night, I sat alone under the flickering fluorescent lights of the dormitory stairwell, clutching my hands to stop them from shaking. I could still smell the vapor in my hair, even after scrubbing. And then, Daisuke sat beside me. "You did well," he said softly. "I heard. I killed him," I replied, barely above a whisper. "No," he said, placing a hand over mine. "You delivered him." There was no judgment in his eyes. Just awe, worship, reverence. And that terrified me more than the death itself. From that moment I changed. Not all at once, but enough. I began moving differently, speaking differently. I accepted the new name they gave me, Hikari Light. It was meant to reflect the path I now illuminated. I buried Haney in a shallow grave at the base of my conscience. And every time I wanted to dig her up, I reminded myself, the world outside doesn't want you. But here you're chosen. Here, your suffering has meaning, even if that meaning drips from the mouth of a dying man. Chapter 3. The Chain of Belief. Belief doesn't arrive fully formed. It accumulates, one compromise, one silence, one betrayal of your former self at a time. By the time I participated in my third trial, I had learned not to flinch, not to question, not to think. Thinking was a relic of the old world, the one I had buried along with Haney. In its place was something leaner, hungrier, a faith shaped not by scriptures, but by submission. The dormitories grew quieter after each phase. Those who once whispered doubts at night now sat in perfect stillness, their eyes reflecting a kind of dead serenity I couldn't name. Some were reassigned to higher tasks. Others simply vanished. We were told they'd ascended, that the burden of flesh was no longer necessary for those who fully understood Asahara's truth. We never asked where their bodies went. To ask was to distrust. To distrust was to decay. And no one wanted to be labeled a decayer. One evening, Noriko summoned me to the shrine room, a dim chamber lined with candles and mirrored walls. I stood barefoot on cold stone as Asahara entered, flanked by two silent guards. He didn't look at me at first. He moved slowly, methodically, as if the air itself bent to accommodate him. Then he turned his gaze on me. I froze. It was like staring into the center of a storm, not chaotic, but suffocating in its calm. I wanted to look away. I couldn't. "You've been loyal," he said, voice like oil on water. "Even after witnessing death, you remained." I nodded. "Faith requires it." He smiled, and it felt like being seen by something ancient. "No," he said. "Faith requires pain. You're ready now to carry the chain." I didn't understand until Noriko approached with a box. Inside, a long, thin chain of silver links, each etched with an indecipherable symbol. She placed it in my hands. "You are now a keeper." The role of a keeper wasn't explained. I was simply relocated to a more isolated wing of the compound, closer to the underground tunnels where only whispers echoed. My new job was to oversee chemical storage, inventory, and documentation. But more than that, I was expected to observe the others. "To ensure the chain stays unbroken," Noriko said. That's when I realized I was no longer being tested. I was part of the machinery now. Daisuke avoided me after that. When I passed him in the corridor, he averted his eyes. He had seen the chain around my neck. He understood what it meant. One night, I found him crying behind the meditation hall. "They told me I wasn't ready," he whispered. "They said I still think too much." His hands were shaking. "Haney, no, Hikari, do you ever regret it?" And for the first time in months, I hesitated. "I don't know what regret is anymore," I said. "I think I traded it for obedience." But that night, alone in my new quarters, I felt the weight of the chain dig into my collarbone. Not just physically, but spiritually. I dreamed of the lab again, of the man collapsing. Only this time, it was Daisuke. And I wasn't behind the glass. I was sealing the door shut. The next morning, Asahara announced that the great purification was nearing. "Tokyo is infected," he declared. "Its people are lost in illusion. But we have the antidote." There was applause. Cheering. Tears. I did not clap. I just touched the chain at my throat and said nothing. Because deep down, I knew what the antidote was. I had made it, diluted it, measured it, and soon, I would help release it. Chapter 4. The Cleansing Hour. They called it the Hour of Ascension. The leaders whispered it with trembling reverence, like a prophecy long awaited, now breathing through our lungs. But among the keepers, it was spoken of more plainly. The Cleansing Hour. And I knew, without needing to ask, that it meant death. Not metaphorical. Not spiritual. Real. Inhaled. Swift. Silent. I was woken in the middle of the night by a low chime echoing through the halls. The lights were dimmed to a deep golden hue. I remember the smell of incense so thick it clung to my tongue. Everyone in the dormitory rose without speaking, like puppets responding to an invisible tug. I followed. Of course I did, even though every fiber of my body screamed to turn back. In the underground assembly room, converted from a former sewage tunnel, the air was thick with anticipation and dust. We sat in rows, silent, staring at a long altar made of steel and concrete. At its center sat a timer, 59 seconds, ticking down in red. A glass cylinder stood beside it, sealed with brass fittings, inside a clear bag of something colorless. Saren, I didn't need to ask. I knew the chemical signature. I could smell the phantom of it even before it was released. Noriko approached with a vial in one hand and a child in the other. The girl couldn't have been more than 8, dressed in white. Her eyes were dull, blank, conditioned. I wanted to scream, but the chain around my neck felt tighter than ever. Asahara stepped forward, his robes trailing across the damp concrete like rot made visible. His voice was soft but steady. Tokyo is diseased. Its people feed on lies, lust, and materialism. Tonight we give them a gift. A cleansing. He turned to the girl. And you, little light, will open the gate. The vial was passed to her. I thought her hands would shake. They didn't. She inserted it into the control valve. The timer began to flash. 5 seconds. For seconds. And for a breathless moment, I believed this was a test. A ritual. Theater. But then, the chamber hissed. The first thing I noticed was the silence. No screams. No gasps. Just bodies slumping. Slowly. Elegantly. As if the air had simply decided to let them go. I didn't move. Couldn't. Because I had been issued a mask. The only one. It was inside my pocket, slipped there earlier by Noriko with a nod and a whisper. You're not meant to ascend yet. So I watched. Watched as the girl collapsed first, her face barely registering surprise. Watched as the followers I had prayed beside and bled beside simply stopped being. By the time the cleansing chamber was cleared, 32 were dead. And I was promoted. Back in the lab, I was given access to the final logistics. Maps of subway lines. Train schedules. Deployment teams. We don't need you to synthesize anymore, a senior chemist said. You've done enough. Now we need your eyes. I wanted to scream that I couldn't. That I wouldn't. But then I saw the surveillance footage of Daisuke. Bound. Gagged. Weeping in some hidden corner of the compound. And I understood, this wasn't a belief anymore. It was blackmail. The chain wasn't symbolic. It was leverage. That night, I found myself alone with the subway maps. Red lines marked the Chiyoda line. The same line I used to ride. The same line where I once stood unnoticed, clutching a briefcase and wondering if my life had meaning. And now, I would help fill it with death. I stared at my reflection in the lab's tinted glass for hours. The face that looked back wasn't mine. She looked like me, but her eyes, they were hollow, hungry, hunted. She wore the chain like jewelry. She would survive this, even if it meant killing what little remained inside her. Chapter 5, The Passenger's Prayer. There's something unholy about silence on a subway. Not the usual quiet, commuters scrolling through phones, heads bobbing to music, but the kind of silence where everyone is too afraid to breathe too loudly. Where you can hear the soft hiss of the train brakes echo like a last breath. That's the kind of silence I sat in waiting. It was the morning of the scheduled test run. Not the full deployment. Not yet. Just a dry rehearsal. A simulation with bags. Real bags, real placement, real timing. But no gas. No death. Not today. That's what I told myself. Over and over again. Not today. I boarded the train on the Chiyoda line, same as before. Same steel rails. Same beige walls. Same distant, automated announcements about the next station. Except now I wasn't a passenger. I was the one carrying the bag. They had trained us in precise timing. Where to sit. What hand to use. How to drop the umbrella just right. Don't draw attention. Don't blink too much. Smile if someone looks at you. We were the invisible operators of a holy act of purification. And somehow, I still looked like me. That terrified me more than the mission itself. Across from me sat an old woman. Her fingers clutched a cloth bag on her lap, rosary beads tangled between the fabric. Her eyes met mine briefly, and she smiled. It wasn't pity or suspicion, just human warmth. The kind I hadn't felt in months, and something in my chest cracked open. I looked down at the bag beside my feet. The fake Saren was sealed in plastic, just like the real thing would be. My umbrella tip, sharpened and hollowed, rested against my leg. My hands were trembling. We weren't supposed to flinch. We were trained not to. But I flinched. As the train rumbled through the next tunnel, the lights flickered, the signal to begin. The countdown was embedded in us now. 10 seconds. 9. I reached for the umbrella. 8. The old woman bent over slightly, adjusting her sock. 7. Her rosary slipped to the floor. 6. She reached to grab it, hands shaking. 5. She looked up at me again, and something in her face shifted. Not fear. Not recognition. Something worse. Hope. 4. My fingers froze around the umbrella. 3. I could hear Noriko's voice in my head. Don't hesitate. Hesitation is infection. 2. The bag was there. Waiting. 1. But I didn't move. 0. Nothing. I sat there, frozen, sweating, suffocating inside my own skin, as the train continued. No alarm. No trigger. No smoke. The dry run was over. And I had failed. That evening I was summoned. Noriko's office was colder than usual. No incense. Just steel and silence. You hesitated, she said, not with anger, but with disappointment that stung deeper. I nodded. There was no point in lying. They already knew. Every seat had been watched. Every second logged. She placed something on the table between us. It was the old woman's rosary. I thought, Noriko said, voice flat, this might help you remember your purpose. I didn't sleep that night. I lay on the thin mattress, fingering the beads, wondering if she'd been a test. A plant. Someone the cult had used to measure my readiness. Or maybe she was just a woman on a train. A woman who offered a smile to someone who looked like she was about to drown. And I nearly drowned in it. The next day, they didn't punish me. Not directly. They gave me a new assignment. You will write again tomorrow, Noriko said. This time with real substance. I looked at the rosary. I looked at my hands. I looked at the reflection in the dark subway window as it passed by. And for a split second, I wished someone would pull the emergency brake on my soul. Because this train wasn't headed to salvation. It was dragging me deeper into hell. Chapter 6. The day the air turned to ghosts. There are days when memory becomes mist. Where the past doesn't replay, it haunts. Where sounds echo even when the world is silent. That day was one of those days. It was March 20th, 1995. The day we were told Tokyo would be reborn. And I was on the train. Again. But this time there was no dry run. No rehearsals. This time, the bags were real. I had memorized the instructions. Board the Chiyoda line at Shinachinamizu. Carry the sealed pouch. Sit near the center. Puncture at 8:01 a.m. sharp. Do not flinch. Do not speak. Leave the train at Kasumigaseki. Discard the umbrella in the trash bin. Walk away. They made it sound so simple. Mechanical. But nothing about what I was about to do felt human. Still, I followed. Because Daisuke was still alive, barely. And they promised I could see him after the mission. Because my chain had grown so tight, I couldn't remember the shape of my own throat. Because after a while, belief stops being a choice. It becomes oxygen. The subway car smelled like detergent and bodies and neon dust. People packed in shoulder to shoulder, their faces dull with morning routine. No one noticed the small plastic bag at my feet. No one noticed the trembling in my hands. No one noticed me at all. And that was the most terrifying part. I was about to unleash death. And the city didn't even know I was there. At 8 hours and 55 seconds, I reached for the umbrella. The sharpened tip pressed against the pouch. 8:00:58. A breath caught in my throat. 8 hours and 1 minute. I punctured. There was no flash. No bang. No scream. Just silence. Then gas. Invisible. Immediate. And chaos bloomed like a sickness. The man to my left began coughing violently. The woman behind him clutched her throat. Children whimpered. The old man near the door collapsed. It was soundless but deafening. Someone vomited. Someone screamed. Someone tried to pry open the doors before the next station. And I stood up, just like they trained me to. Expressionless. Efficient. I walked out at Kasumigaseki, calm as the dead. The moment I stepped into daylight, I expected something to change. A crack in the sky. A tremor in the earth. Something to mark what we had done. But the sun kept shining. The traffic lights blinked as always. Tokyo kept breathing, even as dozens of lungs were filling with ghosts. I arrived back at the compound and was led to the lower hall. Noriko met me there, eyes wide with feverish pride. It's begun, she whispered. The great dissolution. You were flawless. She placed something in my hands. A photo of Daisuke. His eyes were swollen shut, his wrists bruised, but he was breathing. "He lives because of your faith," she said. And I nodded, because if I didn't believe that, I'd fall apart completely. That night, the compound was filled with chanting, celebration. People danced barefoot through the halls, smearing ash on their faces, claiming victory over the illusion of modern life. But I couldn't hear the music. All I could hear were the sounds in that subway car. Gasps. Collapse. Prayers spoken too late. The air had turned to ghosts, and I was the one who summoned them. Later, I returned to my room. I locked the door, and I wept until my throat gave out. I held the rosary. I whispered the names of every station I'd passed that morning, and I begged the universe to forget I existed. Because even monsters pray for mercy once they realize what they've become. Chapter 7, The Undoing. There is a sound a city makes after tragedy. Not sirens. Not chaos. But the slow, aching groan of denial. Tokyo kept moving, even as the morgues filled, even as newscasters choked on the word terror. And I kept breathing, which felt like the cruelest punishment of all. The compound went dark the morning after. Not from fear, from control. Noriko ordered silence. Windows were covered, radios confiscated. The world outside had become contaminated by doubt, she said. We were the last clean breath left. But doubt is a contagion too. And mine had finally reached a fever. I asked to see Daisuke. She hesitated, only for a moment, but then granted it. The room was cold, sealed, and damp with mildew. Daisuke lay in a cot, his wrists still bandaged, face sunken, but alive. Barely. His eyes opened when he heard me. And for a second, I saw something in them I hadn't seen in months. Recognition. Of me. Not Hikari. Not a keeper. Not a ghost. Just. Haney. I did it, I whispered. He nodded. I watched them die. Another nod. And I can't take it back. He stared at me, unmoving. Then, with a voice like torn paper, he said, "Then undo something else." That night, I snuck into the main chemical storage vault. The key was still in my pocket, an oversight from Noriko, or a quiet act of mercy. I didn't know what I was looking for. Redemption? A detonator? A way to erase my name from history? What I found was proof. Files. Maps. Pre-loaded dispersal plans for other cities. Osaka. Fukuoka. Nagoya. This wasn't the end. It was the beginning. Unless I stopped it. I downloaded what I could. And then I started the fire. It wasn't grand. It wasn't cinematic. Just a small flame in the corner file cabinet, fed with plans and lies and pages inked in poison. The smoke hit fast. Alarms didn't ring, because there were no alarms. Why would a cult prepare for its own collapse? I found Daisuke. Carried him. Down the corridor. Past the sleeping keepers. Past Noriko's shrine. She saw me. Her eyes burned with betrayal. "You're not worthy of salvation," she shrieked. And I didn't respond. Because I wasn't looking for salvation. I was looking for an end. We escaped just before the second explosion. I don't know if Noriko survived. I never found out what became of Asahara. But I know this. The compound burned. The plans never reached Osaka. And 32 more trains kept breathing. I never turned myself in. How could I? What would I say? That I helped create a massacre, and then changed my mind? The news showed my photo once. Blurred. Unconfirmed. I became a ghost. A rumor. A whispered what if. Now I live by the sea. Quiet. Alone. I still see their faces, those passengers. That girl with the rosary. But I also see Daisuke. He doesn't say much. But when he sleeps, he doesn't scream anymore. Maybe that's something. Maybe that's all I get. If you're listening to this, if this recording ever makes it out, don't look for me. Don't try to name me. Just remember, belief can be the deadliest gas of all. And sometimes the only way to breathe again is to burn the temple down.